it was honestly one of the most heartbreaking experiences that I've ever gone through. Mm-hmm. Because as I was helping her move out, I remember just looking at all her stuff. I'll be brief here, but just thinking about it, and I still have all the pictures, it was the image of a dream unfulfilled. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Julian.
And I'm Kirsten. Today we're talking about financially supporting our parents. So some background on this episode, because we were originally planning to talk about something completely different, but we recently posted something on Instagram about moving my mother-in-law, well, Julian's mom, out of senior housing, and it got such an enormous reaction. I mean, the comments and the likes just flooded in, and most of it was support, you know, just people cheering us on. Some of it was relief, people thanking us for saying it, saying that this thing that we're doing is probably going to set our timelines back and, you know, what a burden it is. And then there was some inquisitive people who wanted to know more about how we're doing it. And a couple of people asked us to record a podcast about it. So here we are recording while it's fresh.
Yeah. And this is not new. This is something that we've always known is a major topic of discussion. Quite honestly, a really what I call flammable topic of discussion, because the opinions on it can vary so widely. Some people feel like you absolutely should. Some people feel like you shouldn't. Some people, or I'd like to say most people, are somewhere in between. And so we're assuming that some of the listeners out there are somewhere in between, but I'm sure there are likely a few listeners who are on either end. Either way, we're going to talk about that today, because it's a really important topic of conversation, not just for you, but even for us.
Yeah. And I felt like we could switch it up a little bit, since this is very close to home for you, and I interview you a little bit.
Okay.
So why don't we start? I feel like Gayle King, but like not the R. Kelly interview.
I was about to say, I'm not about to stand up and talk down to you.
All right, let's start with softball. Tell us a little bit about how you grew up.
Yeah, so I grew up in Brooklyn, New York City. This was in 1980s, 1990s Brooklyn. For the most part, I grew up in poverty. I was largely raised by a single mother. She's an immigrant from Jamaica. I have a relationship with my father. I would see him every now and then, but they were not married, in full transparency. And our relationship is not the greatest. It exists, but there's tons of room for improvement there. Mm-hmm. As a result, I was raised predominantly by my mom. She carried the burden pretty much from day one. She moved me out of Brooklyn, I would say, in the late or mid to late 90s. We moved from New York to Atlanta. And just financially, I wouldn't say, you know, the word broke is typically used. And the reason why I wouldn't say that we were like flat broke is because there were always people who kind of had less than we were, right? We knew that it could be a lot worse than where we were. But I will say we were always or just perpetually on the edge. There was always just trying to scrape by, and it was mm-hmm. just a constant looming presence, you know what I mean? Like, you could never really feel like we were getting ahead, and it was just a part of life. It was what we knew to be normal, and I would say what I knew to be normal up until my mid to late 20s. Mm. My mom, in the early 2000s, so after we moved from Brooklyn to the Atlanta area, you know, she struggled to find work. She learned very quickly that Atlanta was not like New York.
Right.
You couldn't just, you know, hop on a train or a bus and get to a job and back.
And I'm sure the immigrant community was much smaller in Atlanta.
Completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, we lived in a largely, a very, I wouldn't say diverse, but like in terms of the Caribbean, because the Caribbean itself was pretty diverse. We lived in a part of Brooklyn, Flatbush Brooklyn, which is predominantly known for being a hub or base for a lot of people of Caribbean descent. And so it just felt a little bit more familiar. Even for me, when I came here, it was completely different because I couldn't even relate to the Black people that I knew. Like, they dressed different. They talked different. They didn't understand the music that I listened to. Like, I was completely, you know, thrown off.
Yeah, this was at the time when Atlanta was trying to establish our own voice. You know, it was like Andre 3000 and like a lot of the rappers, the local kids at the time, they were kids, were just trying to establish that the South got something to say. And so there was some animosity actually from New Yorkers coming down here, you know, with your own music and your little accents.
And arrogance, right?
And like, arrogance.
New Yorkers
feel like
we run the world. We're the biggest and best city
in the world.
And in addition to that, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. And so it's like, you know, the heart of it all. Some people would debate Manhattan, but maybe from a business and a commerce perspective, but from a cultural perspective, I really kind of came from that. And so within the Black community, for sure, there was just a lot of discomfort. Anyway, with respect to my mom, I would say right around the early 2000s is when things started to slowly unravel. They didn't get really bad, but you could just tell that her earning potential and power wasn't there anymore. And just slowly but surely, like, we were getting closer to like that edge. And then
what kind of work was she doing?
She's always been in like some kind of secretarial role. She was a receptionist for a while. She was a secretary for a software company in the training department. Like, that was like the peak. But even when she was done with that, she went on and did, I think she actually towards the hype of real estate mania leading up to the Great Recession, she got sucked into the mortgage loan business. And so I remember her getting a certification to be a loan officer, and she tried doing that, and that didn't work out well. And then she left that and then went into working for a nonprofit organization that was still within the real estate industry. None of it worked out. Like, it was just like, at this point, I was just accustomed to that. It was like, oh, we're going to try something. We're going to hold on for about 4 to 5 years, and then it's going to fall apart, and then we're going to find like another raft to hold on to. I'm getting like Titanic visions in my head as I think about it, but that's pretty much what it was. It was like, all right, well, when we're done with this, we'll hop onto the other thing. But we were never really thriving. And at that time, it just kind of felt like a ticking time bomb because I was towards the end of my academic career. I was moving into my professional career. I was starting to earn more money. And I also had debts to pay off, you know, like I had my own set of issues, but I just knew that at some point I was going to have to financially support her. I didn't know when, but I knew that like it was coming soon.
Was she ever explicit with that expectation? Did she ask you to take that on or to think about that as you were picking your career?
No. But I do know that when I think about my own upbringing, right? So when I literally envision our old apartment in New York, and this is standard practice, like as soon as we would walk in, there was like a barrel right there by the door. And every year, probably multiple times a year, what my mother would do is she'd go to the grocery store. Like, let's say you just go to the grocery store for the week, you pick up some groceries, or you go shopping, you pick up some things, and you just fill up the barrel. And the reason for that was because throughout the year, as the barrel would fill up with clothes and housing supplies and toothpaste or things that basically my grandparents and cousins couldn't get in New York, when it got full, she'd fill it up and then she would send it to Jamaica. And so there was always a expectation that that's just what you do. Right. You support your parents because they fought to get you to where you are. They worked really hard to get you to where you are. And it's kind of like the least that you could do.
Now, back then, did you kind of take pride in having that responsibility? Because I know it's part of the cultural narrative. It's just kind of what you do. So did you take pride in knowing that you were sort of next in line to do that? Yeah. Or were you wise enough to understand the gravity of that kind of commitment?
I think as a kid, when it wasn't real, I took tremendous pride in someday being able to do that, right? Like I don't know that I was any different than a basketball player or, you know, an entertainer that aspires to one day buy their mom the house of their dreams, right? I was no different than that. And I think as I started to kind of make my way in my corporate career and in business and even as an entrepreneur, in the early stages, I took pride in that. It became a motivating force. But quite honestly, it turned really quickly when I started to realize like how much it would cost for me to actually like make that happen. And it's kind of heartbreaking because it's like, yeah, you're not going to be able to do that. Like,
yeah.
you can't do that and live your own life and try to raise your own family. I mean, you can, but you would have to make an enormous amount of money to be able to tackle all three. And you would just have to have endless amounts of energy to even fulfill that vision.
Right. So let's fast forward a bit because I actually met you on the tail end of that realization. Mm-hmm. You had already moved out. You had a home. You had a blossoming career. So we met in 2012, got married in 2015, and had our son in 2017. And our son was enough of a reason for your mom to finally retire from her job. She was working evenings in hospice care.
That's
and
right.
It was really taking a toll on her body at that age. And so I remember the day that we told her that I was pregnant. And one of the first few sentences that she said was, "This child is not going to daycare."
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember like, I think I looked at you like, where did that come
I know.
From?
Like, I was like, what does that mean?
Yeah. Like what?
I ain't watching.
Right.
No, I'm just playing. But anyway, she quit her job. He was enough of a motivation. So she quit her job and we actually paid her a stipend, so to speak, to become one of his primary caretakers. The other caretaker was my mom, who also quit her job to take care of this baby. So we were offsetting her retirement even back then. It just felt different because we intuitively knew that she wouldn't be watching him forever. Like he would eventually go to school or to a daycare or something. So what happened after that? What happened after she kind of quit her job and started watching Beau?
Yeah, so that's really when it came to a head because, you know, we were paying her, you know, a couple hundred bucks.
It was more than a couple.
I mean, okay. We were paying her a substantial amount. I don't know what you want to say. You want to get specific? I don't remember exactly how much it was, but we were paying her to watch our son a couple of times a week, and she quote unquote retired, but I don't think she really knew what that meant. I think she just meant like retired was the thing that you say when you just don't feel like going to work.
Yeah.
Like she had not done the math at all.
Right. She was still living the same life.
Correct. And we had gotten into a pretty big argument, actually. I remember. And things got really, really difficult because we got into an argument because I knew that this didn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But there was just a lot of unspoken tension there. And basically she retired, but had not done the math to figure out how she was actually going to support herself. And she was really struggling, especially to maintain the upkeep on her home.
Yeah.
She was in debt. She had no income and, you know, things just got really, really tense. And so we essentially stepped in and had like a financial intervention and said, hey, like enough is enough. We've got to overcome this tension. We've got to talk about these issues, which means that you're going to have to be pretty transparent about where you are. And in that moment, you know, I'd prepared for it. Well, I should say emotionally to the best of my abilities. And I knew that at the time, because we were both working our jobs, that we could fill in the gaps. Like it wasn't a problem. But it was still pretty frustrating because, you know, we had just had a kid. But quite honestly, like I felt like, all right, now we have another kid.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like we've got a 70 plus year old kid and we've got like a kid that's, you know, a year and a half years old. And it was difficult, man.
Yeah, I remember her struggling with it too, because it was also a bit of a role reversal.
Yes.
Where she felt like, and I don't want to speak for her, but just based on the conversations that we've had, you know, she felt like she's the parent in this situation.
Yes.
And you are now coming in asking her how she spends her money.
Yeah.
And it was very uncomfortable. It was a moment of transparency that often felt like judgment instead of, you know, help.
Yeah, so I remember devising a plan, and I remember feeling proud again, like just because we were actually able to do it. Like literally sit her down, introduce her to like financial tools, break it down, help her understand the little that she had left in her portfolio. And basically what we came up with was a recommendation that she needed to sell her home. Mm-hmm. Like that's your best option, right? You have a home that you can't afford to live in anymore. You have debt. The vast majority of your wealth is tied up in home equity. And if the market softens or crashes, you're going to lose everything, right? So we have an opportunity to essentially sell while we're ahead. And she was not open to that at all. She was very much emotionally tied to her home, which makes sense. This was her dream, you know, to always own a home. She very much at the time subscribed to the idea that renting was throwing away money.
And that she was leaving the home behind to us. So that was another part of her narrative was that, you know, if she sold this home, then she wouldn't have anything to leave for us.
It felt like, and I don't, to your point, I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I do remember her saying something along the lines of, I don't remember exactly what she said, but it felt as if, like, you could tell there was a lot of shame involved in this. And it felt like she believed that leaving the home to us was like the one thing that she would have gotten right.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like she had made all these mistakes, but at least I could give this home to you. And honestly, like we were like, we don't want the home. Like we had, you know, and we had a real estate portfolio, which I think was even more confusing for her because we had a primary home, we had a rental property in her mind. At a minimum, it could also become a rental property. Mm-hmm. And we were like, I wouldn't buy this. It doesn't fit my investment criteria. She didn't understand that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, why would I include this other home 45 minutes away in a market that I don't understand the people that want to live there? Like, this is not the type of property that we would have. And so, long story short, she rejected the notion several times.
For almost a year.
Yeah.
A year and a half.
Yep.
I don't want any of I don't want any of the listeners to think this was a quick conversation. We invited her over for coffee and she was like, no, this was a year and a half of ongoing conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I guess kind of out of nowhere, I think it just finally set in. And
she got the call.
Oh, you're right.
She got a call from
I think it was Open Door.
Open Door.
She got something in the mail.
Yep.
Classic senior citizen moment.
Same way you buy a timeshare.
She got something in the mail and said, hey, we'll buy your home. And it had the price listed right there. And she'd never seen so much money in her life. And, you know.
Yeah.
And it was like, we'll take it. No ifs, ands, or buts right now. And she brought it to me. And I said, so you're saying you want to do the thing that I recommended that you do? I couldn't help myself. I was like, okay, I think we should do that. And so that's what she did. She sold the home. It was honestly one of the most heartbreaking experiences that I've ever gone through because as I was helping her move out, I remember just looking at all her stuff and just the act of moving triggered so many things, so many memories that I had when I lived there when I was younger. And it certainly like uprooted a lot of memories that she had of just living there. But I do remember because I documented the whole thing because I shared it, quite honestly, with people on social media. And I want to say that entire day, we probably not received or had more engagement than any other day because so many people felt like, oh my God, that's what it looks like to finally get your mom or your dad to let go of the house and make the right financial decision. And I'll be brief here, but just thinking about it, and I still have all the pictures, it was the image of a dream unfulfilled.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it was.
Yes.
She bought too much house. She believed that eventually she was going to fix the basement up and that could be a separate property and that would offset all these other things. None of it ever came to fruition. Mm-hmm. None of it. Like this room never got finished. That room, it was just a bunch of projects with a bunch of paint on it. But she'd never actually had the money to fix up the house for it to be the type of home that she wanted. And it just reached a breaking point where between the roof and the windows and this crack and that leak and mold and plumbing. And it just reached a point where it was like, listen, take this money and run. And so that's what she did. We finally sold it. I want to say we closed on her literal birthday.
We did.
And she said that it was the happiest day of her life, which was hilarious at first. And then I thought about it. I was like, I'm your only son.
You didn't make the cut.
I didn't even want to know what the second day was, because she probably would have said the day, our grandson or something like that. I was like, wow, like, can I make top five at this point? But she said it was the happiest day of her life, because I want to say she was like 74, 75 or something like that at the time. And it was the first time that she'd ever been debt free. And she, I mean, I just think she felt like an enormous weight, right? She did not have to worry about writing a check the next day. I'm sorry, a mortgage payment the next month. She didn't have to worry about whether or not tomorrow was going to be the day that the roof decided that it had had enough. She was thrilled.
Yeah.
So she found a senior living community that was nearby, and they had availability. She was familiar with the area. And so she jumped on it, and she was like, you know what? This is all I need. I've got enough space. I can do these things, blah, blah, blah. And she loved it at first. And then the pandemic hit.
So yeah, she moved in and on her birthday and stayed there for a year, and then re-signed her lease shortly after the world was just starting to lock down.
Yeah.
Actually, it was shortly before the world was just starting to lock down for the pandemic.
Yeah.
So the first year, you're right, was good. It was good enough.
Yep.
And then re-signed the lease, and she was there all 2020. And that's when the reality set in.
She realized that while she made the financially responsible and affordable decision, that she didn't make like the best decision for her mental health, for her ability to have a healthy and active life or social life. And so the pandemic, on top of just living in a community where, honestly, it felt like every week or every other week, you know, a neighbor or someone she knew was sick or had passed away. Every time we would visit, there was an ambulance outside all the time. I think she just kind of felt like she'd moved into like a hospice in waiting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's an interesting point, because that was the work that she was in.
Right.
Prior to retiring, she was an administrator for a hospice center. And so she was very used to being around sickness and death and families in mourning. And so to some extent, I think she found comfort in it. But I think by the time she had been a year removed, she started to realize that it's not comforting. It actually causes her to catastrophize her future and make her feel like she has less time on her clock, because that's kind of what she's surrounded by.
And we saw that in our interactions with her.
Yes.
Like, she just did not.
Anxious.
Yeah. She was always anxious about things. She was scared of everything.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, she wouldn't even try new food. It was almost like she was afraid that was going to be the moment that she had some hidden allergic reaction or something. Like, she just wasn't the same after a while. And so I give a lot of credit to you for this, for kind of forcing the issue, because honestly, I was willing to let it go a little longer, but you kind of stepped in and said, hey, we've got to do something about this. And I know we planned on doing it, but we may need to go ahead and pull the trigger and do it sooner than we'd expected, which was to essentially move her out of there and bring her closer to us, into a nicer neighborhood where she just had better access to things. I remember you guys would go apartment shopping, you know, every now and then. And even that was a whole process. But finally, you settled on one. And anyway, I just want to say thank you on the record. I've said it privately, but I'll say it publicly as well. Just thank you for leading that effort with her, and for pushing everyone, really.
Please don't mistake this as like, I just suggested it. And Julian was like, hell yeah. Like, no, it was conflict between us too, just to get over the hump of when it's appropriate to actually start supporting her in a more meaningful way. But it was important to me for a number of reasons. Well, two in particular. One, family is everything to me. It is a core value of mine and a motivation for my financial independence. Mm-hmm. And then two, we had been talking about our philosophy for giving for a while. and had recently landed on this idea of solving $1,000 problems. You know, when people think about giving, they tend to add a religious connotation to it, which we don't belong to a church. And so, you know, tithing as a mechanism for giving didn't resonate with us. And then on the other side, people tend to think about giving in this very macro level, like they want to solve, you know, the big problems. And so where we landed was something in the middle, which was this idea of $1,000 problems where, you know, I want to be rich enough to solve $1,000 problems because we're around people in need enough to know that $1,000 at the right time can be life changing. A $1,000 break to a single mom so that she can get childcare, so that she can study for an exam. Life changing. A freezer that supports a community and getting access to fresh foods is life changing. And so we were having this conversation about $1,000 problems. It kept coming up. And when I was having deeper conversations with your mom, a light bulb just hit me. And I realized that one, the most important one that we could solve was right under our nose. And that just kind of helped me reframe it a bit. So let me ask you this. When we were paying her for childcare to watch Bo, it was really easy to reconcile the budget because childcare has an end date. And we were both working traditional W-2 jobs. And one of the benefits that we had at that time was a daycare FSA, which is a tax-advantaged federal savings account that works very similar to the ones that they offer for healthcare. So not only did we have like cushion in the budget, we also got a tax break. So we were highly incentivized to just write the check. But with this situation, we know that your mom will always need housing. And given the inflation rates in that particular category, we'll likely always have to support her. And so as entrepreneurs, we know our income can be inconsistent. And I just wanted to ask, you know, does the fact that we don't have an end date to this arrangement scare you?
No. I'm thinking about this. I'm not worried about the money. I don't want to sound arrogant, or dare I say privileged, but listen, this is an earned privilege. It's something that we've worked and invested, for a really long time to be able to do. If we were in this situation 10 years ago, I don't even know how I'd be able to do it. And so the fact that we could do this relatively easily and have a number of sources in which we could pull from to make this happen, or a number of options available to us that we could undertake to generate the income to make this problem go away. Like this is not a major issue at all. And even when you say end date, you know, I know we just had a conversation on a recent episode about like death. Like that's kind of the first thought that came to mind. So I was like, no, because even if we're just looking at this as a, from a financial standpoint, there are costs associated to handling that end date or her passing. You know what I mean? And so the fact that there's not a necessary end date to this, that doesn't really bother me at all. For me, it was really about letting go of my own aggressive, arbitrary financial targets. You know, I'm very driven. I am very committed to the work that I do. And I am always trying to shorten the distance or the difference between what I say and what I do. And so when I commit to something, I'm really trying my best to make that thing happen. But, you know, very similar to a conversation I had this morning with one of our business partners, I'm working on some of those control issues, because reality is I don't control those things. I don't control that any more than I control what the financial markets can do. I can do everything right in terms of investing, and the companies or the sectors or the U.S. legislation or another pandemic or something like that could happen that disrupts what I want to do. And so to answer your question, no, I'm fortunate to say that I'm not really worried about the money. At all. But the bigger issue is just kind of dealing with my own internal kind of issues.
I'm smiling because it's been an honor to watch you kind of work through that process. I think a lot of us in personal finance, because the math has so many rules and the math is so precise, we tend to use this illusion of control as a coping mechanism. And so I've watched you kind of abandon the other places where, you know, in finance, we pretend to have control, whether it's our budget or our net worth. And so this was kind of the last piece, which was figuring out how we can take on a bigger expense every month. And I just think it's an important part because I think I've talked about this before, but as humans, we tend to think very linearly in order, not just with math, but with our experiences as well. And so we tend to take what we're feeling right now in this very moment and extrapolate it all the way out in the future as if we will always feel this way forever. And we underestimate who we become in the process of doing whatever it is we're doing and how your mindset changes. I mean, you can look at how we've normalized paying $1,300 for daycare every month. That's not to say we're going to miss it when we don't have to pay it anymore. But with things like this, it doesn't serve to believe that we can't find a way to make it work.
Right.
If you had asked me 5 years ago, could I take on an additional $1,300 every month? I'd have been like, nah, I don't know where that's coming from.
Right.
But because we have to, we do. Every month, we find a way, we make a way. So
My other issue, so aside from how I felt about it, was really around how my mother would feel about it. Because, you know, granted, she's not here. Maybe that's what we'll do. We'll get a third mic and see if she can jump in on the conversation. We probably need a patois translator for those who aren't familiar. But, you know, my concern with her was whether or not the nature of our relationship would change, meaning, you know, knowing that she is truly financially dependent on us. And even if she'd hoped for it or finds it as a privilege or, you know, I just was concerned about how she would feel about that. Because, you know, her entire life she's been, you know, an independent woman taking care of herself. And now she's reached this point where she's kind of come to the end and, you know, she's kind of, we are the raft that she's kind of hanging on to. And, you know, I was really concerned about how she would, like, how this relationship, I don't want to call it a business relationship, but how this would impact, like, the nature of our relationship.
Yeah, I hope she doesn't feel that way. And we've had a couple of conversations and nothing she said alludes to the fact that she feels that way. She's always said how grateful she is to us and our ability to do this.
But even that, I don't want her to be overly grateful.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because, like, that doesn't make me feel better. It's like, then she kind of feels like I'm not doing her a favor.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm doing what feels right. Like,
yeah, it's funny you bring this up because I was going to mention Toni Morrison, may she rest in peace, but she had a great perspective on generations and love. And she said, each generation has a kind of love. And some of it is really tough. And she kind of goes on to talk about, you know, what her grandmother thought was love for her children was just staying alive, like pure survival. And then what her mother thought was love for her children was to get a better place and a good education, kind of similar to what how your mother raised you. And now that what she thinks of as love for her children was demonstrating freedom and setting an example for the choices they can make for their lives. And I think that what we're doing is not only building off the love that your mom showed you by ensuring that you got a good education and a better shot at life, but also setting an example for Bo about how financial freedom allows us to show up for people in different ways.
Yeah, I love that because, you know, even when I think about my own motivations, you know, it kind of seems like we're all kind of motivated by Bo, who's our son. Because he certainly, you know, is top of mind whenever I'm at some of these crossroads. I think about not just the decision itself, but I think about how I navigate this decision and what impact it has on his ability to navigate similar decisions if he ever has to do it. We will likely be the example that he references. And so we have an opportunity not just to improve our lives today, but to impact his life in the future. So we are officially, and we have been for a while, but it feels a little more definite now. We are officially a part of what's called the sandwich generation. And so for those of you listening, if you've not heard that term, basically the sandwich generation is a term used to describe people who are financially responsible for their children and aging adults. And so according to the Pew Research Center, as of, I want to say it was 2015, about 47%, let's just go ahead and say half of adults in their 40s and 50s have a parent who are age 65 or older and are either raising a young child or financially supporting a grown child.
Wow.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised by that at all. When I think about when we first launched our blog, that was without question one of the unsaid obstacles that a lot of people that I knew were facing, and they just were not willing to confront because there was just so much drama and tension centered around that idea. It impacted their relationship with their partner or spouse. It impacted their relationship with their parents, their children. They just kind of accepted it. It is what it is. I can't invest because I never know what's going to happen tomorrow, and therefore it's best for me to either just stand still, not do anything, mm-hmm. and kind of wait for something to happen. But it's one of, if not the most challenging financial dilemmas that I think most people, or I guess I should say that literally half of the people, at least in, that are in their 40s and 50s, have to deal with.
Yeah. And I'm usually, you know, positive Pollyanna and always looking for the bright side and the lesson, but I don't want to romanticize the situation. Sometimes the sandwich feels great, like a panini. And other times, that bread is soggy and the sandwich is squished. Like this, being a part of the sandwich generation is not all,
yeah,
you know, positive. And it's not an easy situation because there isn't really a blueprint. We're in this watershed moment where we've decided as a culture collectively that we're not going to take care of the elderly.
Yeah,
the safety net catches them in terms of healthcare with Medicaid and Medicare, but not so much with housing. And so even before the pandemic, I read that 3 in 4 nursing homes were understaffed and 4 out of 5 had recently been cited for failures in infection control. And with the policies changing around immigration laws, 1/4 of nursing home workers are actually immigrants. They fall into the same category of jobs that your mom held when she came over to this country. And so as things continue to shift and our political landscape is quite volatile, like that piece of the safety net is also, you know, falling apart. And so it's just it's a really tough place to be. And I think something that would benefit us all is to talk about it and to try and figure out, is there a policy solution in addition to sort of these individual solutions that we're all trying to cobble together?
Yeah. In our video series, Money on the Table, so for those who don't know, in addition to our podcast, we have a video series. We have one season under the belt. It's called Money on the Table, where we basically blend our love for food with our passion for money. And we have great conversations about a particular financial topic while enjoying a meal. Mm-hmm. Season 2, we're hoping to film, not hoping, we will film this summer, and it'll be fun. But in the first season, one of the best episodes was the episode that we had my mom on.
Oh, it was the most popular one.
It was the most popular
secretly
one.
Secretly shared. Yeah. We saw the shares, y'all.
Right. But it was popular because it did exactly what it was supposed to do, which was model the behavior that we want other people to have. We know that other people want to have conversations about, hey, like, so what's going on with your money, or what are your expectations for me? And, you know, how did you kind of get where you are? But they don't really know how to start. And so what we did by filming our conversation is give people a potential starting point that they could use to have their own and navigate their own conversations with their parents. It's also with our book, which is scheduled to come out in 2022, we have an entire chapter dedicated to the subject because we know that it is, as we've said, a really important topic. In our case, it's particularly polarizing because our parents are on completely different ends of the spectrum. And so we've spoken about my mom and her financial insecurity. But I think for me, what makes it, I wouldn't say challenging, but particularly difficult is that your parents are thriving at the same time, right? And so on one end, we have my mom, who's struggling, but your parents, like, literally are about to have, like, matching Teslas. And I'm not saying this, like, to, you know, to, like, poke fun at either party, but, like, the it adds another dimension to it, because when we're together or around holidays or something like that, these kinds of differences kind of reveal themselves. And it's always kind of interesting to see the two.
Yeah, I think my dad identifies with you and your mom's psychology more than you think. It's why he hasn't actually retired. His upbringing was very similar to yours. And if you let him tell it, he graduated from the school of even harder knocks than mm-hmm. you did. So much of his identity is wrapped up in a perpetual struggle and a mistrust of systems and people to care for him. And so he's the one who made it, and he knows there isn't a safety net for him. And that's kind of the fuel in his tank. I'll also call out that I think culturally, the expectation that they're going to leave this, you know, grand life for us isn't really there for them.
Yeah.
They are kind of spending their our inheritance while we're here.
They sure are.
So they can enjoy they the experiences it. With us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not mad at that. Like, at the end of the day, if you leave something, great. But I'd much rather, you know, this is the friction of millennial values versus boomer values. I would treasure the experiences more than I would, you know, money. I mean, well, let me rephrase that.
Well, we're doing that as well, right?
We've yeah.
had quite a few family vacations. We have another one coming up. And so it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. I mean, inheritances are important. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that I don't want an inheritance if they choose to leave me one. Mom, if you're listening, yeah. Dad, if you're listening, don't go changing the will. But what I'm saying is I appreciate their balanced approach of not just like hoarding money in the hopes yeah. of, you know, us spending it after they're gone at the expense of like not having a good time today.
Yeah, yeah. So this has been a longer conversation that we typically have, but I think it was an important one. So hopefully you guys hung in there. If you were looking for a magical solution,
we ain't got one.
you are out of luck. We do not have one, but I can offer a couple of recommendations. The first one we've alluded to, but I will reiterate. And the first is you have to talk about it. Avoiding this conversation, not just with your parents, but with your partner or your spouse or your brother or whoever else is involved, is not the solution. Because what eventually happens is some kind of life-changing event brings it all to a head, and you're dealing with the grief or the challenge of that issue in addition to trying to navigate the financial impacts of that situation at the same time. And you don't want to be in that situation.
And I'll add a resource to that. Our friend Cameron Heddleston has a book called Mom and Dad, We Need to mm-hmm. Talk. She is an absolute expert on the subject and guides you through how to navigate the topic. Like, don't go in there talking the way you've normally been talking if it isn't working. I love Martha Beck's sex advice, where she says, if something isn't working, don't do it harder. It's the same is true here. Like, if your conversations have not been working, then you need to switch something up. And Cameron's book is a great resource to start.
So speaking of Cameron, she's actually connected us to the two owners of an app, and I'll recommend that app as well. So there's a new app called Careful, and that's Careful with two L's, Careful. And this app is designed to give visibility to people like us. And so let's say my mother signed up for the app. We would basically have visibility into all of the financial accounts that she has connected through the app. And so when you think about elders and them being a little older, maybe a little slower, maybe a more prone, not even maybe, statistically more prone to fraudulent issues, right? This gives you the visibility and the access into some of their financial accounts, hopefully all, assuming you can connect them all through the app. So highly, highly recommend checking out the Careful app. You can download it. It's a free app, and at least have some visibility into what's going on with their spending, assuming they're open to that conversation, going back to the first recommendation.
Yeah. And then last but not least, we will be coming out with an episode on how to deal with life-changing events. And in that episode, we'll talk about dealing with death, estate planning, and offer a few solutions for you that you can better use to manage these types of situations. So stay tuned, hit the subscribe button, or check our show notes page to get those resources. Final thoughts. You want to go first or you want me?
No, we'll stick with you.
All right. So my final thought is that a lot of tension that people have in their relationships stems from these types of unspoken expectations between parent and child. And if you think that's you, one of the worst things that you can do is idly wait for your partner to bring it up. These things are unspoken for a reason. They're very delicate subjects. And so if your partner is going through this, approach it with compassion and curiosity instead of judgment and impatience. And even with those white gloves, you should expect conflict. It took us many, many rounds of talking to get to this point over several years. In fact, somewhere our videographer has some behind the scenes footage of us having an argument about this very thing after the episode of Money on the Table with Julian's mom came out. So the point is, there will be conflict. I think we've said it a couple of times in the episode of how things were heartbreaking or hard or how it felt like a burden. But this is conflict worth having. If you expect your financial journey to be conflict-free, you are living a fantasy. This is the kind of conflict that you need to invite into your life and trust that you have the tools to resolve it.
Wow, I love that. You know, when we think about this podcast and what we wanted to accomplish, this feels like the purest representation of life at the intersection of money. We could talk about tactics and the things to do all day long, but the reality is, like, life is just really complex. And so I'm really glad that we had this conversation. My final thought would be that this conversation is relevant whether you're from a well-off family or an economically fragile one. It doesn't matter, right? The issue, the numbers may be a little different, but it's a challenge for just about everyone. And there's no good time to have it. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you're thinking, hey, I'm going to wait until after the celebration or before that celebration, we've had those issues too. My mom came to our wedding and was dealing with some issues and we didn't find out until afterwards. And that just created another issue. Your parents, like, all it's there's never a good time. You may be thinking, oh, well, I don't want to ruin dinner on Sunday, or I don't want to challenge or make Thanksgiving or Christmas more difficult than it already is. I'm telling you, if you get into the habit of punting and avoiding those issues, you're likely running the risk of making it worse. So very similar to the advice that we're giving into a separate episode, my best recommendation would be put it on the calendar, maybe put it out maybe 6 weeks or 8 weeks out. That way people have time to think about it, to emotionally prepare for it. If there's paperwork and things involved, it gives them time to collect the passwords, to find out where all of those things are. That way everyone has a better and fair shot of kind of showing up mentally and literally prepared to have a productive conversation.
That's great. You don't know what you don't know. So there's only one way to find out, which is talking.
To talk about it.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening to another episode of the Rich and Regular podcast presented by Success. This one was a little long, but we hope that you hung in there. We hope that you can share this episode with someone that you think really, really needs to hear it. And if you liked what you heard, please leave us a rating and a review. Till next time.
See y'all next week.